Amar lahen ze ta'an bracha v'ze eino ta'an bracha. That the reason that you don't need to slaughter the amaret is because when you slaughter an animal, so you get to make a bracha. If you slaughter an amaret, it's not even worth making a bracha. Okay, great.
Are these rabbis who wrote this psachim? These are people who are living in Babel, or they're living in Eretz Yisrael?
Excellent, excellent question. That's exactly where I wanted to go. So, first question we have to ask ourselves, basically, and this is a tiny question: what is the Bavli? Right? So what is the Talmud Bavli? What is the Babylonian Talmud? And more importantly, when the Babylonian Talmud quotes sources from Eretz Yisrael, like a Braita, so what does that mean? Is it reflective of the reality in Eretz Yisrael?
This is a Braita?
Yeah, so right, when it starts, Tanu Rabbanon, so that indicates that this is a Tanaitic source.
And Braita can only occur in Israel.
Ooh, excellent question, right? So
it was also, what, 400 years before this?
Right. So we're beginning to see already, right? So this class is well trained in methodology, right? So the question we have to ask ourselves is, what does it mean in a vacuum to find a brisa, a Tanaitic source in Babel, right? So the Tanaim, almost entirely, if maybe one exception here and there. So right, the last generation of Tanaim is basically the generation after Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. So people like Bar Kappara.
So that's like 200?
So right, we'd say, I suppose, the mid-third century is about when things transition. Yeah, mid-third century. The Mishnah is edited in the early third century of the Common Era. And then about a generation or two later, we're already in the Amoraic period.
Okay.
So what does it mean in a vacuum to find a Tanaitic source in the Bavli? Right, the Tanaim are all living in Eretz Yisrael, so what does it mean to find a Tanaitic source in the Bavli? And more importantly, what if we are to find a Tanaitic source in the Bavli that doesn't appear in, let's say, the Yerushalmi or in other Eretz Yisrael sources? So what does that lead us to believe, or what does that lead us to conclude about how the Bavli is presenting this?
Because
the Bavli
is presenting...
Yes, excellent question. The answer is yes. Often there are often... And when we finally get to the Bavli, which will be in a bit, but when we finally get to the Bavli, we're going to have to take very serious account of this. How do we deal with parallels between the Bavli and the Yerushalmi? How did the Achronim deal with this, or who comment on the Yerushalmi? And how should we deal with it? But very often, very frequently, in fact, I'd say in a majority of cases, when we find Tanaitic material in the Bavli, it's paralleled in sources from Eretz Yisrael. It may not be identical, but it'll be paralleled. So in this case, what are we to make of this? Is this attitude... So first of all, how do we characterize this attitude towards the Amei Haaretz?
Pretty hostile.
I'd say hostile, right? To say the least, hostile. When we get to the Bavli, we're going to have to discuss the Bavli's view of the Amei Haaretz. But for now, this view, at least, is presented as originating in Eretz Yisrael. In an early period, Rabbi Lazar here is probably Rabbi Lazar ben Shamua, who's one of the early Tanaim. So this is sort of this is attributed to sages who at an early stage are interacting with other people in the land of Israel, and it seems like the relationship is exceedingly hostile. The rabbis want nothing to do with any of the people around them.
This is set after then.
So this is set in the, I'd say, sort of mid to late second century. That's when this is set, of the Common Era. So it's right set after the Bar Kokhba revolt, I would say, right?
So this is coming from Yavne? Is it coming from...
Ah, so that's what we have to ask ourselves. Where does this come from? So first of all, I think we need to sort of set some guidelines, right? When we want to figure out what is happening in the Tanaitic period, or what is happening in Eretz Yisrael in general, so I think it would be wisest, or it would be most prudent of us to set our research parameters as follows. Let's take only sources that originate in Eretz Yisrael. Let's go through them systematically, see what we can find in them, and if they match what we find in the Bavli, or at least reasonably so, then we can begin to talk about a conclusion about how do rabbis relate to Amei Haaretz, why isn't this hostile? But if the two do not match, then we're going to have to ask ourselves, why don't they match, and how do we account for the distance between the two? So let's take a look at the sources in source number two. There are dozens upon dozens of sources that deal with the relationship between rabbis and Amei Haaretz. But I've only cited a couple here, but I think they're representative. So we're going to go through them, and we're going to have to figure out what they say, and more importantly, what they don't say. So first of all, let's pay very close attention to how how the relationship here is conceived. Who are the players? Right? Who are the people involved? Is it just rabbis or is it maybe other people? So who are the players? And more importantly, what's the tone? Right? What is the tone of the relationship here? And why is it that way? So the first source is from the Gemara in Yerushalmi in the Gemara in Demai. The Gemara tells us as follows. So it's commenting on a Mishnah. The Mishnah had told us that a piece of challah that an Amaretz has, so the law that we're dealing in the challah is not just challah like we have at a Shabbos table. So challah is the biblical requirement that when you have a piece of dough, you have to separate a certain amount out to it and give it to the Kohen. So let's say you have an Amaretz who has a certain piece of challah. So the rule in the Mishnah is that if he gives it to a Kohen doesn't have to take extra truma and maser from it. So the question is, why would you think he would have to take truma and maser from it? Didn't the Amaretz take it himself? So we're going to have to deal with that question in just a moment. So the Gemara tells us as follows. Amar Rabbi Yochanan b'shah shegazru al hadamai, lo gazru al devarim halalu. So Rabbi Yochanan says, and Rabbi Yochanan is an Amora of the second generation, late third century, living in Eretz Yisrael. So Rabbi Yochanan says, at the time when whoever, the rabbis, or Mar will identify people who are responsible for this, but when whoever made a decree on Demai, they did not talk about these things. Now, what is Demai? So Demai is a special halakha category that is developed in the Mishnah that is specifically geared towards dealing with the Am Haaretz. What do I mean? So normally the rule is that when a person has produce, when a person brings in produce, you have to separate out a couple of things from it. You have to separate out truma, which you give to the Kohen. Then if it's a Levi who receives, who rules, so then before, after you separate out truma, you have to separate out maaser. You have to separate out a tenth of the produce for a Levi. And if it's a Levi has to separate out then trumas maaser, right, a portion that he gives to the Kohen. Then you have to separate out after the truma for the Kohen, after the tithe for the Levim, then you have to separate out a second tithe, which will either be Maser Sheni, which you bring to Yerushalayim, or Maser Ani, which you give to poor people, depending on the year. So those are all the tithes that you have to separate out from your food, right? So you don't just bring your produce into your house, you have to actually give a lot of it away to people who require it. Priests, Levites, and poor people or God, right?
Does this still pertain after the Korban Beis Hamikdash?
The status of Maseros, Trumos and Maseros Bizmanazez is an important question.
Even at this time.
Right, so we're going to actually have...
Let's talk about this time.
Right, so we're going to deal with that question right now. Right, we're going to deal with that question right now. So what happens is as follows. Normally, if a person says, if a person wants to give you a piece of bread to eat and says, here, eat this. So the first question you should ask, you would think, is did you separate out Trum and Maser? Because if you eat it and Trum and Maser hasn't been separated out, you're chayiv misa bidei shamayim, at least for in certain cases. You are obligated in death at the hands of heaven. So, normally, if a person gives you food, you would think that you would have to ask, did you separate all these Trumas and Masers? How do I know? Maybe you're lying. So the answer is no. Normally, if a person hands you a piece of bread, let's say, you don't have to ask those questions, you can just eat it. However, if a person is an Am Haaretz, if a person falls into the category of Am Haaretz, again, we're going to have to define what that means. We're going to spend a lot more time in that next week, but we're going to have to briefly define what an Am Haaretz is. So if you are an Am Haaretz, you are not trusted to have separated out especially anything other than Truma, right? All of the other tithes, Truma you are trusted to have separated out, but everything else you're not trusted to have separated out. So if a Am Haaretz wants to give you a piece of bread, we call it demai. It's not tevel. Tevel is food that certainly tithes haven't been separated out from, but we call it demai, something that we don't know exactly what it is. It may be good, it may be bad. So when it comes to demai, so now demai is basically the halacha category that defines an Am Haaretz. Now, so far, what do we know about what do we know about an Am Haaretz? What characterizes an Am Haaretz?
He's not Jewish.
Is he not Jewish? In other words, he's separating out Truma, right?
Yeah.
All right. So what is that? What do we know about him?
He doesn't do halacha.
So let's think about this. He doesn't keep halacha. So Dr. Schwartzbaum is leading us down the right path. So in other words, when we say he doesn't keep halacha, So what halacha are we referring to? All halacha?
No, truma.
Tithing.
Right, he takes out truma, right?
We're assuming.
We assume, right? But that's generally the assumption. So he takes out truma, but we suspect that he may not be as punctilious when it comes to, let's say, maaser, right? The rules of maaser.
Ignorance or from malice?
Ooh, right. So it's an excellent question. So why is the Am HaAretz not doing this? That's crucial. Right, if it's just ignorance, then we would ask, well, why don't the rabbis just teach them? If it's malice, that brings us back to the Bavli, right? They're just animals, right? And we hate them. But maybe there's an alternative, and we have to ask ourselves what that might be. So, right now, we know the following. Normally, you cannot accept produce from an Am HaAretz without taking out Truma and Maser just to be safe. However, a Mishnah had told us that if and Am HaAretz gives challah to a priest, we can assume that all of the correct trumas and masos were taken out. The question is why? So Rabbi Yochanan says, well, we just simply, the original decree on demai simply did not apply to those cases. But the second explanation we're given may be a little more helpful, at least for us as historians. Amar Rabbi Hoshaya, Emas kadshim alav, ve'ena nosin lekoin, davar she'ena metukan. B'chalas Am HaAretz, adaiti Rabbi Hoshaya, b'chalas Am HaAretz imas nisa. Aval chaver shalokach isa me'am HaAretz, v'hifrish chalasa, lo. So Rabbi Hoshaya says, an Am HaAretz is not punctilious for himself. However, he knows that priests normally need to be able to eat their food in a state of ritual purity, and normally need to be able to eat their food having all of the correct Truma and Maser taken out. So when it comes to priests, and Am HaAretz knows that a priest, that a Kohen, is somebody who is very fastidious and punctilious about halacha, so he's going to make sure that he gives him the right stuff. So when it comes to a Kohen, so we can always trust an Am HaAretz to give the Kohen what the Kohen requires. Now, the Gemara points out here, but if a person who is careful concerning the tithe and ritual purity status of food purchases dough from an Am HaAretz and wishes to separate out its challah, this is not the case. Now, what does that mean? So the Yerushalmi has now introduced another character into the mix. And who is that character? A chaver. Now, what does a chaver mean?
Who cares about...
So we have two perspectives here. Lior is saying someone who cares especially about something. We're going to have to define what that is. Dr. Schwartzman says, a regular Jew, right? So this is important. In other words...
Between the Yerushalmi and the Bavli, there's a major distinction. You know, the Yerushalmi...
All right, let's get right into it.
The Yerushalmi almost seems that it's talking about non-Jews, Am HaAretz, the people of the land.
Yeah.
And the Yerushalmi, it almost seems to talk about Jews as he's a Jew, but he's ignorant or he chooses not to. It almost seems to me that it's too, you know,
using a term to describe two different things.
This is excellent. So there are a bunch of things in here that we have to unpack. They're all going to unfold, I think, over the next couple of sources. But let's unpack a couple of things. Number one, I think, I could be wrong, but I think that you're picking up actually on a syntactical anomaly or a syntactical distinction between the Bavli and the Yerushalmi. Right? So in the Bavli, Dr. Schwartzbaum's intuition is that we're talking about almost like Gentiles. I mean, we know they're Jews, but we're treating them like Gentiles. Why? So how is the Am HaAretz described from a grammatical standpoint in the Bavli?
From the Bavli, that they were Jews, they seem to have been the people who were just there.
Right, they almost seem like, in other words, if we had the
like
fuller...
Like the land and these people were there.
Yeah, so if we had the fuller context in the Gemara Msachim here, we would see that the Bavli knows that they're Jews. Oh. It's just, but I think what Mrs. Deegan is pointing out is this rhetoric is so stark, it's essentially treating them as non-Jews, right? We wouldn't want anyone to speak about non-Jews this way. Forget Jews. But what, grammatically, how is the Am HaAretz described here?
Like animals.
Singular or plural?
Singular.
Oh.
So there is one singular, but what else is there in the second line?
Right? They are the
Yeah.
Thing.
Right. Velo Yisa Bat. Right. So Mrs. Deegan is picking up, and Dr. Schwartzman. Velo Yisa Bas Ame Haaretz. The nations, plural, of the land. Mibnei Shehain, as Mrs. Deegan says, Shekets. Right. They are detestable. And they, so on and so forth.
It's almost like with Asa marrying, you know.
Right, the nations of the land, right? We're going to have to talk about that next week. So here, they're almost being described as an arrival group, right? This is a whole group of people, and they're all rotten. You should note that this actually is pretty consistently maintained between the Bavli and the Yerushalmi. In the Yerushalmi, there are 6 references to plural Ame Haaretz, to a group of people who are in Am Haaretz. In the Tosefta, there are 10. In the Mishnah, how many? 1. In the Bavli, there are 44. So in the Bavli, the tendency in the Bavli is much more to relate to these people, not as individuals, but as an entire group that can be characterized in a single way. So I think Dr. Schwartzbaum's on the right track here. But in terms of getting back to our Yerushalmi, so we have to ask ourselves, who is this new character? Who is this Chaver fellow? So the answer is that a Chaver, so if we were to go through all the sources where he appears in rabbinic literature, so the Chaver is someone who is very careful, even after the temple has been destroyed, and even though he's not a priest necessarily, not a Kohen, it doesn't have to be a Kohen, to eat his food in a state of ritual purity. So a person wants to make sure he's tahor, and all of his food is tahor when he eats his food. That is what a chaver is. So, this source in the Yerushalmi is describing the relationship between an Am Haaretz and a Kohen on the one hand, and an Am Haaretz and a chaver on another hand. Are there rabbis in this source? Not really. I mean, the rabbis commenting, but we haven't seen any rabbis in this source. So an Am Haaretz isn't necessarily opposed to a rabbi, or a person who's, let's say, a rabbinic Jew, quote-unquote. And Am Haaretz here is opposed to a chaver. Now, what more does this tell us about an Am Haaretz? What characterizes an Am Haaretz? If a chaver is someone who's really careful about tahara, so who is an Am Haaretz? Someone who's not careful about tahara, and we've seen not careful about trumos and masters. That is, as far as we know, the only defining characteristic of the Am Haaretz so far. Moreover, what sort of relationship does the Yerushalmi imagine that there is between an Am Haaretz, potentially at least, between an Am Haaretz and a Kohen, and an Am Haaretz and a Chaver, between an Am Haaretz and other Jews who are careful about rabbinic laws, let's say? There's a business relationship. They're buying and selling things together. They're sharing food with each other. Okay, take a look at the next source. The next source is from the Tosefta. This is a Tanaitic source from the land of Israel. The Tosefta tells us, "Beno shel am haaretz shehaya lamed etzel chaver, o avdo shel am haaretz shehaya lamed etzel chaver, kol zman shehein etzlo, harei hein kechaver, yatsume etzlo, harei hein kaam haaretz." The son of an am haaretz who studied with a chaver, or the servant of an am haaretz who studied with a chaver, for as long as he stays with the chaver, he's considered like a chaver. In other words, we can eat his food and we don't have to take extra truman maser from it. When they depart from him, they are considered once more like an Am Haaretz. Okay, so what sort of relationship does the Tosefta imagine is taking place between the Am Haaretz and the chaver?
It sounds to me like you would say that they're in the same place. They're living. They're getting their food from the same source. They're living in the same source.
Sound like roommates. They're in the same place. They're interacting with each other. In fact, they're studying with each other. Now, what are they studying here?
Does it say? It's unclear.
It doesn't say. If you'll recall, this is last semester. So those who were here last semester, this is going to be Chazara. We talked last semester when we went through the archaeological evidence from Beit Shan, from the catacombs there. Okay. So, and we were discussing what does the title rabbi mean in antiquity, in archaeology, and in rabbinic literature. So we saw that the term rabbi can sometimes refer not just to a teacher of Torah, but in a very tiny minority of cases, and also that seemed to be earlier, a rabbi can mean a person who teaches umanus, a person who teaches crafts, right? So this meaning ends up falling out of use. And here the term rabbi isn't even used, but it's clear that I think at least the Am Haaretz here is studying a trade with the chaver, right? And as long as he's with the chaver, he is treated like a chaver. But when he leaves, it's not like he's studying Torah with him. It's not like he knows all the halachos of being a chaver now, because when he leaves, he goes back to being an Am Haaretz.
It's almost like you're saying if there's somebody who's working in the rabbi's house.
Excellent. That's exactly what it is.
And that she's bringing you food from his house, that's fine. If she's bringing you food from her own house, that's not fine.
Right. I think that's exactly the case. So here we're anticipating a case where an Am Haaretz is interacting with a chaver, not because he wants to become a chaver, but because they just interact. And that's how life is, right? Now, again, I think at this point we still have the sense. Now, in other words, what sort of relationship are we imagining here? Antagonistic?
It sounds like a friendship.
It almost sounds like friendship, right? Now, another, you can't eat their food, or at least you can, but you have to do a little bit extra, right? So it's not like we would consider them part of maybe the same halachic circle. I don't even know what term to use, but they do seem to be part of the same community, right?
Yeah, well.
That's the impression that I think we have. Sort of. Now, take a look even further down. Take a look at the next source, the Yerushalmi in Bikurim. The Yerushalmi in Bikurim quotes Rabbi Meir, who's a Tana, as telling us the following. This is part of a longer sugya that discusses the obligation that a person owes to an older person. Rabbi Meir, Chame afilu sav am haaretz, umekam lemin kamay, amar lo magan ma'arech yamin. Rabbi Meir would see even an elderly am haaretz and would stand up before him. So normally we say, Mipnei seva takum v'hadarta pnei zakein. So normally the way that we internalize this, you stand before somebody who is elderly if that person is also in some fashion suitable for being stood up for. If the person is a rotten, terrible person, you wouldn't stand up for Stalin, right? So you can, but this guy,
I got one for you.
Yeah.
Isn't that the case? Have you ever seen, certainly we tend to do it for rabbis, regardless of the age, rabbis.
Yeah.
So I got a question for you. Have you ever seen people do it for a woman?
Yeah. Sure, of course. Yeah. Did it yesterday.
Okay.
So, okay.
No.
So here, so just to get back to the source here.
At a wedding, you get up for the grandma.
I've seen vintage when they don't stand for the wife.
So just to get back to the source here. So Rabbi Meir says, why is he standing up for an elderly am haaretz? Right. So you would assume that he's an am haaretz. Why would you stand up for a guy who is possessed of amaratzus, right? So the answer is lo magan ma'arech yamim. It's not for nothing that he's remained alive for this long. The assumption that Rabbi Meir makes is that there must be a reason why God has kept this person around. This person must be a righteous person in some fashion, right? So Rabbi Meir is here willing to, and keep in mind who is saying this, Rabbi Meir. That'll be important later on. Rabbi Meir is very clear that he sees latent potential in the am haaretz for righteousness, even if it's true at the same time that there is an entire halakhic category, demai, that has been created because of the am haaretz's either ignorance or lack of loyalty to the halakhos concerning trumos and masros and tahara and purity. Okay. Now finally, take a look at the source after that. The source after that, I think, is even more stark. Asya de Rabbi La, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish. Now, just a little bit of grammatical preface. So the Yerushalmi is well known for the following lexical anomaly. Whenever there is a word that begins with an aleph, usually a name, so the first aleph falls out. That's why you have things like Amar Reb Lazar, right? Which is short for Amar Reb Elazar. So in this case, you have Amar Rebbe La, which is short for Elah, like Rabbi Yehuda bar Eli, right? So that's the name of Elah. So there's the story goes that there's a Jewish historian from a few generations ago, still alive, who embarked on a translation of parts of rabbinic literature. He was reviewed by Shaul Lieberman, he's the great Shaul Lieberman, and Shaul Lieberman was not impressed with this translation. He pointed out that one of the places that he made a terrible mistake was when he translated this, something like this, Amar Rebbe La, as Amar Rebbe Lo, and Rebbe said no. This is not, and Rebbe said no, this is the name of a person. Rebbe La is the name of somebody. Rav, or Rabbi, Eloi. Okay, so in this case, it's not Amar Rebbe Lo. Similarly, you could say, you know, Amarav Chametz B'Pesach, Chametz Shavar Lava Pesach. It's not Amarav Chametz, it's Amarav Chametz Shavar Lava Pesach. So the same thing would be here. So now, in accord with the opinion of Rabbi La, is the following story about Rav Shimon ben Lakish. What was Rabbi La's opinion? Rabbi La's opinion was simply that just because a person is a Talmid Chacham doesn't mean that we treat him like a Chaver. Okay? That was the opinion of Rabbi La. Now the Yerushalmi is going to illustrate that with a story, that just because somebody is a Talmid Chacham does not necessarily mean that person is a Chaver, is presumed to be a Chaver without any further proof. So the following story. Rav Shimon ben Lakish have a salak lagabi ilein devei Rabbi Yanai, v'havu nishaya chazyan lei, v'arakan min komoi. Amar lon, evo lachon baisa, am haaretz ani etzel taharos. So Rav Shimon ben Lakish, the great Reish Lakish, the colleague of Rabbi Yochanan, of the 3rd century, 2nd generation of Amoraim, lived in Eretz Yisrael. Reish Lakish was coming to the house of Rabbi Yanai, and when the women of the household saw him coming, they started to flee, and presumably because they were concerned that their food was not going to be suitable for Reish Lakish in a state of purity. The Achronim discuss what is going on here exactly, but we can work with that now. They were worried that their food wasn't going to be suitable for Reish Lakish to eat. And Reish Lakish responded to them, don't worry about your food not being pure enough don't worry that there are people in your house who are impure, because I am an Am Haaretz when it comes to eating food in a state of ritual purity. Reish Lakish says, I'm an Am Haaretz when it comes to eating food in a state of ritual purity.
It's just like a nice rabbi story where you're trying to not embarrass anyone.
True. Yeah, it could be, right? It could be. Now, so in other words, Lior is making...
He doesn't want to make them feel bad. He's like, oh, I'm just an Am Haaretz. You can give me, don't feel bad about not having anything tahor for me.
Right. So Lior is making a good point. In other words, this could be hyperbole, right? This could be Reb Shimon ben Lakish just not wanting to inconvenience people whose house he was arriving. That could be. Now, and moreover, you can imagine stories like this, right? You can imagine in an Arts Girl biography, right? You can imagine, this rabbi saying, oh, I'm just a nobody, I'm a humble person, I'm this, I don't know anything. Now, what could you not imagine? What you would not imagine Reb Shimon ben Lakish saying is, don't worry about me, I'm an idolater when it comes to purities, right? So I think we would be hard-pressed to find something like that. Hyperbole that goes so far that it actually makes you into something terrible, not just something innocuous or average.
But Am Haaretz could just be an expression, I'm an ignoramus,
Right, well, it could be something like that, right? So it could, Am Haaretz here could mean ignoramus, but ignoramus with respect to what?
No.
So here it's also, again, it's taharos, right? With respect to purities.
Maybe there's an evolution going on.
That's my fault.
Right. So
Reish Lakish is saying, okay, it's the 3rd century, Beis Hamikdash is destroyed, maybe,
Right, so we're going to get to this question.
And looking at what's going on and is holding on to these trumos and masros when there is no Beis Hamikdash and there is no central...
Right, so we're going to get to this question of how long does it take for people to stop being strict about ritual purity? We're not strict about ritual purity nowadays for the most part. How long does it take for that to peter out? So people assumed, I think, in an earlier generation that it petered out very quickly. The evidence archaeologically suggests that it took a very long time to peter out, 400 years, maybe more. So Reish Lakish is still living in a time period when people are eating food in a state of ritual purity. So it could, even if this is hyperbole, and even granting the passage of time, it is striking to me at least that Reish Lakish would use an expression along the lines of I am an Am Haaretz when it comes to ritual purity. Because we've seen so far that Am Haaretz so far has not been used colloquially, at least in any of the sources that we've seen, to mean anything other than a technical term. Right, it's not used colloquially, I don't think, to mean ignoramus, or we haven't seen it used that way yet. It's been used to denote a particular halakhic category of a person who is not believed to have separated out trumos and masros, who is not believed to have maintained himself in a state of ritual purity. Right, so that's what we're dealing with. Reish Lakish, even if he's using this hyperbolically, is at least considering it within the realm of possibility that somebody like him, or somebody in his station, or somebody in his world, could be an Am Haaretz. Right? That's, I think, the only way the comparison works. So now, at this point, if we had to assess what the Yerushalmi sees or what Eretz Yisrael sources see as the relationship between rabbis and the Am Haaretz, so what would that relationship be? And let's try to get some of the complexities. Right? So, I mean, let's start basic. Is it hostile, something else? So what do we see here? Right, I'm glad about this.
To an extent.
I like that, right? So it's cautious, right? So everybody here is
Bavli, it's really not negative. It's really
right. So before we get back to the Bavli, so the Yerushalmi seems cautious. I like that, right? There is caution. I think there's also a willingness to accept that we're part of the same community and sort of
dealing with what they have at present.
Right. No. Right.
They're
Right, they're dealing with Masha'in of Ro'os. They're dealing with what is before them. And what is before them is a community where an Am Ha'aretz and a Chaver and a Rabbi and so forth are freely interacting with each other, going to each other's houses, eating each other's food, and so on and so forth. And they're just preparing for that reality. I don't think there is at least so far, I don't think we've seen anything really wholly negative. We've just seen an awareness, right? An awareness that the Am Ha'aretz are not necessarily to be trusted for certain things. Now, to the extent that an Am Ha'aretz could just be seen as a common Jew living in the land of Israel, your average Jew, so I don't think the assumption so far we've seen is that they're not halachic Jews. They, or in other words, in the broad sense of the term, it's not like they're not keeping Shabbos, they're not keeping Erevin, they're not keeping all sorts of other things. They are specifically not trusted with regard to two categories of halacha. Trumas and Masros, and ritual purity. So if we wanted to construct the model right now about how rabbis see themselves in relation to the rest of the people in Eretz Israel, I think what we would say is they see themselves as involved in the lives of these people, even if they're not necessarily influencing all of them. Right? I think that would be how we would construct the model here for the rabbis, which I think is a very cautious model. Now take a look at source number three here. Source number three gets us to potentially negative portrayals of the Am Ha'aretz in sources from Eretz Yisrael. So let's see what we can make of this. Ubedosim and Herkinus Omer, Shina Shel Shachris, V'yayin Shel Tzaharayim, V'sichas Yeladim, V'yeshivas Bati Knesios Shel Am Ha'aretz, Motzi'in Esa Adam Min Ha'olam. So Ubedosim and Herkinus says that sleeping during the morning, wine in the evening, conversation with children, and sitting in the gathering places, or maybe the shuls, of the Am Ha'aretz removes one from the world. Okay. Now, this is from Pirkei Avos. Reb Dosa ben Hyrcanus says here that going to a base knesset, now base knesset can mean a shul, or it can mean what the word, what it's translating in Greek. Beit knesset is translating a Greek word, synagogue. Synagogue is where synagogue comes from. It literally just means a place where people gather. It doesn't need to mean a synagogue. If you're in a place where Am Ha'aretz are gathering, that's going and talking with them, that's going to take you out of this world. By the way, this is the only place in the Mishnah where the plural of Am Ha'aretz appears, where they're conceived of as a group. So now, does this get us to the Bavli?
Sort of, it's negative.
Maybe. Right? It's negative, right? In other words, it sounds like it's not great to be speaking with them, right? So maybe this does get us to the Bavli. Now, let me ask you a question. What else is in this? What else is in this Mishnah? So sleeping in the morning, right, makes you seem like you're lazy. Drinking in the evening, right? So you're a drunk. What about the third thing?
Talking to children, maybe not learning, like being infantile.
Here we go, right? I think Mrs. Deegan is getting us on track. So speaking with an Am Ha'aretz is not evil. It's just the equivalent of speaking with children, which is to say the ideal for Mishnah Avos, for the Maseches Avos, is that you should be having conversations that are appropriate for a Talmud Chacham, right? Mishnah Avos is, in a certain sense, is geared towards, I think, people who are already Talmidei Chachamim or are aspiring Talmidei Chachamim. So if you're spending lots of time talking with children, that's time that you're wasting because it could be time that you're spending having serious conversations. So having a conversation with a child is like having a conversation with an Am Ha'aretz, which is to say that an Am Ha'aretz is not what?
Learned,
not a Talmud Chacham. Right? So, I think that's the most that we can drag out of this.
Is that the same reason why it says, oh, Soling of it, you shouldn't spend time speaking to a woman?
It's possible. In other words, it could be possible that the Mishnah assumes that just as a matter of reality, not as a matter of ontology or sort of prescriptive norms, it's a matter of fact. Women at the time weren't necessarily as educated, so it could be that that's coming from the same. Could be that that's coming from the same place as this. But in any event, so I think what we have here, I think one of the most negative comments that we're going to find in rabbinic literature from Eretz Yisrael about Am Ha'aretz, so it's not clear that this is hostile, it's just simply aware of the differences between Talmidei Chachamim and an Am Ha'aretz, which is to say, a Talmid Chacham is learned and devotes himself to serious conversations regarding Torah, whereas an Am Ha'aretz does not. Now, finally, what I'd like to do before we draw some conclusions is put this all in perspective. So what I want to do now is trace one thread from the Bavli. Just to say, we saw at the beginning of this class an really intensely negative attitude displayed towards the Am Ha'aretz, sort of the what sounds like, and we'll have to question this next time, the common people, right? Which led us to believe that the rabbis saw themselves as really marginal. They didn't have any relationship with the common people. So far, we've seen that, in fact, the rabbis are portraying themselves as very much a part of the fabric of life of the common people, and they see themselves as one more member of the cast of characters there. So what I'd like to do is see if we can take a thread in the Bavli and trace it back to the Yerushalmi. And if it's possible, then great, and then we'll sort of have something to talk about. And if not, then we're going to have to ask what that means. So take a look at source number 4. The Bavli in Psachim, from that same source that we read earlier, tells us the following. Tanya. Hayu Rabbi Meir Omer, kol hamasi bitu la'am ha'aretz, ki'ilu kofta u'menicha lefnei ari. Ma ari dores v'ochel v'ein laboshes panim, af am ha'aretz maka uboel v'ein laboshes panim. It is learned in a braita. Rabbi Meir would say, any who marries his daughter off to an am ha'aretz, it's as if he bound her and placed her before a lion. Just as a lion attacks and devours without shame, so does the am ha'aretz attack her and cohabit with her without any shame. Here, again, I think the tone is unmistakably negative and hostile, and also I think it sees the am ha'aretz as the enemy, right? Sort of as an enemy group of people.
But can I just ask you, the Bavli was written in a different country. Does that have anything, even though this is from a Braisa that came from Yerushalayim, does that have anything to do with the...
Right, so this is going to be a question that we're going to have to ask. We're going to put it on pause until we get to the Bavli, but we're going to have to ask ourselves, what does it mean? What does it mean when the Bavli quotes a Braisa? So if the Bavli quotes a Braisa, and it's paralleled in a source from Eretz Yisrael, so we can sort of begin to reconstruct how we get from one to the other. But if a Bavli quotes a Braisa that doesn't appear in any source of Eretz Yisrael, so we have to ask what that means. Should we just say, well, somebody made it up? Or should we say it comes straight from Eretz Yisrael and just forgot it in the Eretz Yisrael sources? Or is it something in between? So we have to ask ourselves what that means. We'll get to that when we get to the Bavli. But for now, let me ask a question. What is this source, what potential recourse does this source give us when discussing the question of how we get from the relatively innocuous sources that we've seen so far to the Bavli, which is virulently anti-Am Ha'aretz. So what possibility is there here?
Well, this is have business dealings with them, you cannot marry them.
Yeah. Right, maybe that's it. So who is saying this?
Rabbi Meir.
Rabbi Meir. So we've seen Rabbi Meir earlier.
This year is
talking just about plain old marriage, right? This is going beyond ties. But we've seen a person here. Now, we've seen, as Lior noted, we've seen him before, Rabbi Meir. So what possibility is there here? Maybe the Yerushalmi, Eretz Yisrael sources as a whole don't perceive a negative relationship towards the Am Ha'aretz, but maybe there are discrete individuals in Eretz Yisrael who are very negative about the Am Ha'aretz, and they, the very prominent figures like Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, begin to shift people's opinion towards what we find in the Bavli. So that might be one possibility, but we have to ask ourselves, is there a way to test that?
But Rabbi Meir here says that he would stand for an Am Ha'aretz.
Excellent, right? So what we have to do is we have to go back to the sources from Eretz Yisrael, collect everything that is attributed to Rabbi Meir, and ask ourselves, is there anything here that points us towards what we find here in the Bavli attributed to Rabbi Meir? So, right, as far as we know, there's only one Rabbi Meir that's quoted in rabbinic sources, right? If this was Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, for example, we could say, well, maybe it was a different Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, right? Because there are multiple Rabbi Yehuda Hanasis. If it was, you know, Rav Kahana, there are at least 4 Rav Kahanas, right? So we would be in trouble. Rabbi Meir is a pretty unique name here. So take a look at the Tosefta of Avodah Zarah. This is the last source. This, I think, if we collect them all together, this is, I think, the most negative thing that Rabbi Meir ever says about an Am Ha'aretz, and we have to ask if this matches what we find in the Bavli. The Tosefta tells us, "Ve'ein nosnim lahen benos banos rather lo gedolos v'lo katanos." Divrei Rabbi Meir, the Chachamim omrim nosnim lo gedola uposegim amanash lo tasatayros lagabav. The Tosefta tells us the following. Rabbi Meir says that you are not allowed, or that one should not marry off a daughter, whether a minor or an adult, to an Am Ha'aretz. And the sages say, no, you're allowed to, as long as she's an adult, you're allowed to marry her off to an Am Ha'aretz, as long as you just make a condition that she won't prepare food for him that requires him to maintain a state of purity. Right? And in order to illustrate the point that the rabbis are making, And in order to sort of cite a view that agrees with the Chachamim, so the Tosefta quotes the following source: Ma'aseh Rabbi Gamliel Azakin Shehisi Esbito LeShimon Ben Nesan Al Hakohen Upasak Imo Amanah Shelo Taaseh Taaras LaGabav. Rabbi Shimon Ben Gamliel, rather Rabbi Gamliel Hazakin himself, from the time of the Beis Hamikdash, married off his daughter to an Am Haaretz who also happened to be a Kohen. Shimon Ben Nesan Al the Kohen, and he just made a condition that she just won't prepare certain types of food for him. Right, so that supports the notion that you can marry off your daughter if you want an Am Haaretz. And then finally, we get back to Rabbi Meir. Ve'esahu Am Haaretz. Kol she'ino ocha chulin b'tahara div Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir is asked to define an Am Haaretz. If Rabbi Meir really hated Am Haaretz, here was his chance to really go to town on them. What is an Am Haaretz? Someone who doesn't eat his food in a state of ritual purity. That is Rabbi Meir's definition. So what do we take away from this? So what do we take away from this source? Let's just deal with the Tosefta first, right? What is Rabbi Meir's concern, does it seem?
Rituals, food being eaten.
Right, food purity, right? Just in other words, you have to be careful, right? You want to eat food in an ideal state of ritual purity. And although it's possible, as we've seen from the story of Rabbi Gamliel, at least in theory, to maintain that, even if you're married to an Am Haaretz, so better not to take the chance. That's Rabbi Meir's position. So what is Rabbi Meir's attitude towards the Am Haaretz here?
It's consistent with the Yerushalmi earlier.
It's consistent with the source Meretz Yisrael that we saw earlier, which is to say that an Am Haaretz is not an evil person, it's just someone that you can't expect much from, but he may, as we saw earlier, have hidden depths. That's why Rabbi Meir would stand, or at least it's attributed to Rabbi Meir, that he would stand for an Am Haaretz.
I'm wondering if the conditions of the time were such, like the conditions of Orthodox Judaism in the beginning of the 20th century in the United States, that these rabbis were scared of losing.
Ah, so right.
The
so
people,
we
and the whole thing here in the 20th century, the whole thing of a Hashkama minyan, it was put on so people should go home and go to sleep, but so they could go to work after they went to shul on Shabbos. And I'm wondering if the same thing is reflective of the time.
All right, so I'm glad you brought this up, because I think what we're forced to conclude based on our analysis tonight is that the really horribly negative attitude towards an Am Haaretz is a product of the Bavli. So we have to ask ourselves, and we'll get to this when we do the Bavli. I don't want people to go away thinking we're not going to answer for the Bavli and give the Bavli the due kavod that it, of course, deserves. But the Bavli, this view of the Am Haaretz, I think, is a product of the Bavli. It doesn't exist in any source of Eretz Yisrael. We could collect them all, and this class would just be 15 times longer, but we would come up with the same, I think we'd come up with the same answer no matter what. So we're going to set aside for now the question of why the Bavli is the way it is. I think Mr. Deegan is hitting on something important that we're going to get back to in a future class, but for now we have to ask ourselves two things. Number one, how do the rabbis see themselves? Just as a historical question, this is going to set us up for next week when we talk about Christianity. How do the rabbis see themselves impacting your average person? And is the Am Haaretz the average person? So question number two we can't really answer, right? We don't know enough yet to know if the average person is an Am Haaretz. It sounds that way. The word Am Haaretz makes it seem that way. It's just an average Joe who lives in the land. But even for these people who are not keeping certain rabbinic halachos, the rabbis see themselves as very much a part of their lives and don't necessarily see them as the enemy. They just see them as just another feature of the landscape, of the local landscape in Eretz Yisrael, and let's say 200, the year 200 to 400, that we have to deal with. All right, that's pretty much, I think, the perspective that we've seen in the source of Eretz Yisrael. Now the question that we have to ask ourselves is, who cares? Right? Why is this important to us? So I'll leave you with something that occurred to me as I was preparing this. And it's always, I think, very fraught to draw modern-day conclusions from any analysis of sources dealing with an Am Haaretz, because ultimately, in whatever analogy we draw to make this relevant for us, somebody is going to be compared to an Am Haaretz, and that is it's irresponsible and it doesn't feel very good. So I'd like to preface this by saying that whoever ends up being compared to an Am Haaretz, we should all realize that we are all somebody else's Am Haaretz. Which is to say that as much as we like to think that we are all following in the footsteps of Chazal, and I think we've put, over the course of the last 2.5 years, a lot of effort in this class into demonstrating, I think, why precisely we do see ourselves in this community in continuity with Chazal. But that said, we should be wary of being too confident here. We, as I said, we are all somebody else's Am HaAretz, and we should proceed with due caution. That said, there's a conversation, or several conversations in our community, and broadly defined, that I think are, we can call sort of hot button issue conversations, whether they be about women's issues, the place of homosexuality in halacha, and that sort of thing, where I am very concerned about the following, and that is, there are those within our community, there are many people who advocate different positions with which I disagree, that I think are broadly within the mainstream of halacha, and the question is a matter of values, but there are those who I think are on women's issues and on issues of homosexuality and halacha and the like, who would take positions that I would consider just personally to be beyond the pale of halacha. So the question is, if we can all agree that there are such people, so what do we do with those positions, and what do we conclude for ourselves when we meet people like that? So I think the answer is, on the one hand, we have to be very clear about where the line is, right? We draw a line in the sand that the halacha is X, and beyond that, we can go no further. But at the same time, I become concerned that when we draw those lines, so what tends to happen in our community is that when we draw those lines, we tend to leave not just the rejected halachic positions on the other side of the line. We don't tend to just leave those behind. We also leave all the perspectives that go into building that position behind. And sometimes I think that ends up throwing out the baby with the bathwater. So for example, take controversial women's issue X. So assuming that we can identify a halachic position that would go beyond the pale, for me, let's say that might be partnership minyanim. So let's assume that we've identified such a position. So the concern that I would have is that even if we've identified, let's say, a partnership minyan as being beyond the pale, and we could have an argument about whether or not that's the case, but as an example, once we've identified that as being beyond the pale, I think there is a very great danger in leaving behind not just the technical partnership minyan structure itself, but also all of the concerns, all of the pain that is felt in not being able to participate in tefillah in a way that feels fulfilling. Not being feeling sometimes as if you're erased from our communal conversation and our conversation with God. Those are really very important feelings that I think need to be incorporated into our conversation going forward, and I worry that people are not as sensitive to them because they're so associated with rightly or wrongly, with positions that are beyond the pale of halacha. So here I think what we have is a really fascinating model. The rabbis of late antiquity, Chazal, are interacting with a community that it makes no bones about is beyond the halachic pale. There are no excuses in halachic literature made for the Amei HaAretz. They simply take positions that are unacceptable. They don't separate out Maisos the way that they should. They don't maintain the status of ritual purity the way that they should. And they're not sensitive enough to the needs of the Chaver as the way that they should be. And that's simply unacceptable. And no excuses are made for them. Right? A spade is called a spade. Very much so. And there are people like Rebbe Meir who are willing to say that, in fact, those lines in the sand are so stark that we actually do need to maintain some communal standards. Perhaps you shouldn't marry into a family that sort of maintains those sorts of halachic standards. And if you do marry into such a family, you should at least be clear about what you're getting yourself into. So we can imagine a communal model like that. And yet, at the same time, there is, I think, very much an effort on the part of Chazal to maintain all of these moving parts, all of these different characters, a Chaver and an Am HaAretz, maintain them all within the same community. And there's no antagonism to that, right? There's no pushback, I don't think, against the notion that an Am HaAretz will study with a Chaver. A Chaver will be a doctor for an Am HaAretz. An Am HaAretz and a Chaver will be buying and selling food with each other. And at the end of the day, if an Am HaAretz walks into a room, and he's old, and he's a good person, and he's lived a good life, and listen, he doesn't separate out Maisos the way he should, you stand for that person, even according to Rebbe Meir, because such a person may have something good to teach you after all. That model, I think, is very much a wholesome model, and one that we should be adopting. In our communal conversation, when there are so many, I think, very important halachic values at stake, we should be wary of insisting that those are the only important things that matter in this conversation. Halacha is obviously of paramount importance, and yet at the same time, I think we should maintain as a parallel concern the importance of maintaining community and of maintaining the perspectives of those who don't necessarily share our attitude towards halacha. So that is my thoughts on the Am Haaretz, and I'm looking forward to next time.
Do you think they were fearful of losing them more people?